What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X, and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
Hello, hello, hello. I'm Ray Harkins, and you're listening to 100 Words or Less, the podcast. Thank you for joining us on this fine afternoon or evening or morning or dusk. I was just trying to think of some other times of the day, but yeah, thanks for joining us. And the guest this week is Mr. Jeff Rosenstock, artist extraordinaire, troubadour of the people. I was very excited to have this conversation with him. And I know I always say very excited, but this is a person who, I've respected the sort of output that he has done for a while in regards to music and the sort of message that he has pushed across and just kind of how he's trying to do things on his own terms while also still existing within the context of the music industry now rather than what he was doing previously, because his previous band was called Bomb the Music Industry, right? So yeah, that was that. But anyways, I have to tell you about something that's near and dear to my heart, and that is a good friend of mine, Mike Mowry. He runs a record label called Outer Loop Records, and I want to play you a song from a band of his called Chasing Safety. Now, this label has been around for a while, but now they are kind of relaunching because they've signed some new bands and they want to get the word out there. So, this band is called Chasing Safety. And I'll just let you listen to the song and you can tell me what you think about it. And then we can go forward from there. So, here is Chasing Safety and just a little clip of it called Brand New Prison. That's the end of the song. So, hear that in. If you dug that, you should go to allinmerch.com/outerloop, and you'll be able to pre-order the record. The record is, it's really good. It's, like I said, the song's called Brand New Prison, and the record is called Nomad, and that's due out January 6th of next year, which is insane that I'm saying 2017, but yeah, it's like right around the corner. So yeah, go check it out, because Outer Loop Records, they're doing cool things. They don't focus on sort of trends. They focus on bands that they think are, kind of excelling at their own genre of music. So I always appreciate that. So thank you very much, Outer Loop Records, and Chasing Safety as well. So moving right along, the outpouring of support that I've had in regards to many of you who heard the news last week that my wife was diagnosed with cancer, and we're in the middle of it right now. She actually had her first treatment of chemotherapy today. And I just can't thank you enough as a human being to human being. Obviously, this world we live in is sometimes, not sometimes, a lot of the times, very, very scary. And we have no idea what each day will hold. And just to have that sort of connectivity and support and genuine concern about myself, my wife, my son, this journey isn't going to get any easier. But the support that all of you have kind of just rallied around has been, to me, that's the most overwhelming thing. It's just so, it's so beautiful. So thank you very much. And, you know, actually, my wife and I have been recording some conversations that I may end up posting a little bit later, whether or not it's its own separate sort of little podcast thing or whether it will be published on this feed. I'm not 100% sure, but she actually came up with the idea and I was happy to oblige. So anyways, that is that. And like I said, Jeff Rosenstock, just stoked on life. I was really glad to have this conversation with him. And he's just in the midst of doing so many cool things. I'd really, really recommend listening to his record that just came out this year called Sorry. And the fine people at Side One Dummy Records put it out. And you can just tell that guy works really, really hard at what he does. So anytime anybody puts that sort of effort into the music that they create and the vibe that they are trying to put across, I love it. So had to have him on the show. And at times our connection gets a little spotty, not to the point of where I felt like I had to throw the entire conversation out. But there are just little moments where it's kind of like it breaks up a little bit. But just wanted to front load that if in case you're like, I need pristine audio quality, which if you're listening to this show, then I'm sorry, you're just never going to get that. But you're going to get as close as I possibly can do in regards to a contained / studio recording. So anyways, here is Mr. Jeff Rosenstock, and I will speak to you after the show's over. You and I are roughly the same age, and we definitely have many, many mutual friends, but it was one of those things where I think I got keyed into you, obviously, when Bomb Music Industry was happening. And initially, it was one of those things that I saw, obviously, the sort of manifesto that you had and what you were attempting to accomplish, and frankly, were accomplishing. Initially, it was just like, oh, that's a cute idea. Like, I wonder if that'll work. but the thing was, and I don't mean to use the word cute as demeaning, but it was just like...
No, it's not. I mean, is this on right now, or are we just talking?
Oh, no, we're on, my friend. We're...
Okay, cool. We're, perfect.
Well,
I mean, I kind of just thought it was a cute idea, too. I don't think it's so demeaning. Like, there wasn't, like, a big fucking, like, all right, we're going to take over the world. Like, even though I was talking loads of shit, that was just because I thought the music industry was dumb, and, like, I was frustrated with that. But, like, I didn't think it was going to become a whole fucking thing. Like, I was just making records in my bedroom, you know?
Yeah, no, totally, totally. But you know, the thing that made it obviously endearing to a person like me, and I know many others, was like, obviously it came from a very real and earnest place. Like, you were attempting something obviously from the heart, and you can kind of tell it. But I presume at many points in your, you know, whatever experiment, whatever you would like to call it, of that there were points where you kind of drove yourself crazy with a lot of the rules that had been kind of, you know, set in place. Or was it one of those things where it was just like, oh, if that doesn't work for me now, then I'll kind of throw that away.
It was more of the second thing, but it wasn't like, if that doesn't work for me now. It was just kind of like adapting to new situations. Like, Bomb the Music Industry, as a starting thing, wasn't really supposed to be anything. And so as it grew and as we toured and stuff like that, and then towards the end where touring was like a thing that we were doing a lot of and going internationally and stuff like that, we just tried to kind of adapt to the vibe of the start, if that makes sense. You know what I mean? So like take shirts, for example. That's a big thing. That's something that, like, I do always kind of wonder if we could have just done it without ever selling shirts or ever selling records, but we did, and that happened. But it was like, we people kept asking for us for shirts. So for most of the people listening who don't, like, know, the thing about Bomb the Music Industry for a while was that we did not sell any shirts. We didn't want to sell merchandise. I specifically didn't want to. I'm sure my band members got frustrated with that at points in time. But so if you brought a shirt to a show, we would spray paint a shirt for you. We'd just make a shirt and then you wouldn't have to spend any money, and it's cool. You could donate if you want to. And like before we had vinyl records or anything like that, like towards the end of where we literally had nothing, like we were bringing in like between $100 and $200 a show just on donations. So it was like, it was working out kind of cool for like a small band to like have that much. It seemed cool to me. But like, yeah, we would tour a lot and people who didn't know about that would just kind of get frustrated and just be like, oh, I just want to fucking support your band and you won't let me. And, right. You know, there's a point where like, I felt like if we're annoying people more than who like, if we're annoying people who like us and want to support us, we should probably not do that. We should probably appreciate that these people want to help us out and support us. So, that's kind of like just an example of how we evolved. So I think that like having a set of rules, while it kind of seems like that, it wasn't really like that. Like the whole point of punk is fucking no rules. And I think the whole point about the music industry was to not really have a set of rules necessarily, but like, to not follow the rules that somebody else had already set in place, which is that if you want to be a band, you have to sell things. And I didn't want to sell things. I just wanted to record it on my own and put it out. So that's kind of how that all happened. It wasn't like trying to be like, all right, we have this punk ethos and we're gonna fucking show everybody something. Like, it wasn't really like that. It was just like I was a lonely kid tired of bullshit, and so I wanted to do things the way that I thought I always wanted to do them, you know?
Yeah, oh no, absolutely, I totally get it. And it was cool because like with that sort of you know, ethos that you're obviously injecting into what it was you were doing, you know, obviously it's very akin to what other bands have done, but it's like, I remember there's I'm based here in Southern California, and there's this you know, label slash distribution company called Ebullition Records that's based in Santa Barbara, you know, kind of definitely along the sort of, you know, hardcore punk sort of vibe, but you know, they had a lot of these bands that you know, very very strictly adhered to the you know, DIY. Like, you know, they were like, no fucking barcodes on our records. Like, you know, we're rallying against the system in the same way that you obviously were doing. But there was similar vibes where a band, they would, as opposed to selling merchandise, they would go to a local thrift store, buy like, you know, 20 or 30, you know, $2 t-shirts, screen print, you know, their band logo on, you know, some terrible, like, you know, pizza delivery shirt or whatever, and then sell that for like $5 at the show. But it's like, the spirit is obviously, I think, what really endears people towards it. It's not so much the execution. It's the fact that it's just like, oh dude, someone's fucking trying.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And I mean, and my band before Bomb, we did stuff like that too. We'd see, like, I remember going to Old Navy and there being like a closeout on like soccer style shirts, and they cost like $1.50 each or something like that. And we just bought like as many of them as we could and screen printed our logo on it. And we did that, you know. I think with Bomb, a big thing was like, I just didn't want to sell anybody anything. I didn't want to sell anybody anything at all. I wanted people to be able to come see us play and not feel like they were obliged to spend money beyond the ticket price at the door, you know, just somewhere where you could kind of be safe from capitalism, which is, you know, which just is never the case anyway, because even if, and I kind of learned that later on with like house shows and stuff like that, like even if you're playing a house show and it's like suggested donation at the door, like a lot of the times people will choose to spend their money on like a 12 pack of like Bush instead of like throwing in like $5 towards the door towards a touring band. So instead of like, you know, putting money in to like the arts, to the thing that you're supporting, you're giving it to a big corporation. You're like, oh sick, this show's free, I don't have to pay, I could get drunk.
Right.
Which is like, I think like as stuff went on, I kind of was realizing things like that. It's just a matter of how to like navigate it in a way that I still feel like, we're not really, that we're still a band for somebody who doesn't have the money to spend on shit. And we try and do that still now, like the solo records are still free and, you know, trying to still be able to do stuff like that.
Yeah, for sure.
You hold on just one second.
Yeah,
my phone's on vibrate, and it's probably going to keep picking up on the thing. Come on, phone. Do a better job.
It's definitely not the user. It's a piece of technology.
Yeah. Yeah, these things don't work. No, Skype was making it hard, but now I'm good. All right,
good,
cool.
Good.
No more beeping during the talk.
Oh, it's okay. I didn't hear it at all, so we're good. But
oh shit!
No, dude,
I could have gotten away with it.
You could have been multitasking.
Yeah.
So you yourself, were you born and raised in Long Island, or was that kind of where you just you grew up?
Yeah, I'm born and raised in Baldwin, New York. Probably not born in Baldwin, born at a hospital in another town, but I am from Baldwin. Yeah. And yeah, that's where I grew up, and it's a place where I lived.
And so what was your family structure like mom and dad in the house, brothers and sisters? What was the makeup?
Yeah, I don't, mom and dad, brother and a sister. Brother and sister were super, super, super smart, which was kind of strange for me growing up because I wasn't smart at the same shit that they were smart at. And I was just kind of weird growing up. I was like, oh, fuck, you know? like for example, can you still hear me?
Oh, yeah, yeah, no, I'm good.
Yeah, yeah, like for example, my sister like writes for The New Girl, and my brother is currently like applying to be a fucking astronaut. So like me as like a little like ska kid is just like, hey guys, wait up.
I can see that where it's just like, yeah, we're on different creative life paths, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But they're both super funny. I love them a lot. They're great. I love my brother and sister.
Yeah. And what did your parents do as you for work as you were growing up?
My dad is a lawyer and kind of was just doing his own thing with that. And my mom was an art teacher. It was an elementary art school teacher, which was convenient because I'd have like markers and stuff to play with all the time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The added benefit.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then, God, and when I started making zines, it was like, cool. Make the copies at mom's school, cut them up with mom's paper cutter. Sick. Awesome. You know?
Yeah. Basically, she was your built-in Kinko's.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Dude, that's incredible. And so then, you know, what kind of kid did you find yourself being? Is obviously you were starting to, you know, go to junior high and high school and your, you know, identity, what you gravitated towards and stuff like that.
I don't know. I mean, I think when I was in elementary school, I don't know. What was I doing? I was doing like a lot of, I know that I was doing a lot of community theater stuff, which is weird. And I was doing it because my sister was doing it. And I was just like, oh, my sister's doing this cool thing. I want to hang out with my sister. I don't know. It ended up being like a strange, tense thing where I felt a lot of pressure to like do things correctly during it. And I feel like just like not fucking up lines or fucking up like blocking and stuff like that. Cause like you'd get yelled at. It didn't matter how old you were. Like they'd give you shit if you fucked up.
Right.
Like I think after, and that like started, that kind of, is where I started realizing that I was a very anxious person, in that situation. And that kind of like, once I hit junior high, I stopped doing that. I started getting into like punk stuff, like Green Day had happened. And so I was like doing my own research or trying to find bands of my own. But, I felt like a lot of the people who liked that stuff in my junior high and stuff, like, they're all skateboarders and stuff. And I couldn't skateboard. And like, I just like couldn't hang with them basically. Like I was like a fucking nerd who was into this stuff, and they were certainly cooler than me, probably cooler than I am now. So like, I don't know. I kind of just went to junior high and, was kind of floating around and didn't really know what to do. And I was like into music and I had a few friends but like, it was just kind of like, I don't know, I felt lost for a while. And eventually through like listening to punk and metal, I stumbled across Long Island hardcore stuff. And From there, kind of ended up finding ska stuff and realizing that like I could be a part of like local shows and shit like that. And I think once that happened, I really kind of figured myself out. I was just like, oh, fuck, I could be in bands. I could play in bands and stuff. And me and my friends would start bands. We'd play shows and we'd book shows. And it was really fun.
Nice, nice. Well, I didn't know. I actually presume that your origin was mostly more rooted in ska, but that, so you mentioned Long Island Hardcore, I presume like VOD, Silent Majority, all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, yeah, Silent Majority, Cleanser, Tension, Glassjaw, The Warped Weeble Wobbles, fucking Vision of Disorder, like VOD, that VOD tape that was going around Long Island was just like, it was awesome. It was great. I listened to that thing constantly, and yeah, I'd go see VOD, and we're all really proud of them when they signed to Roadrunner, and then when they signed to Roadrunner, we all probably called them sellouts once the record came out, you know, punk stuff.
Right, right. No, totally. It was. I think VOD was the first band that I really kind of recognized as being, you know, hometown heroes, so to speak. Because, like, I mean, they would play out here in Southern California, and they would do really well. You know, they'd play to like 300 to 500 people, and that was, and the shows were, the shows were incredible. But I just always heard the lore of obviously how well they did in Long Island, where it was like, oh yeah, you know, they'd play the PWAC in front of like 1,500 people. It was like, holy shit, like that's nuts.
The record release show was at the PWAC, and it was them and the Warped Weeble Wobbles, and I can't believe I can't remember the other bands who played. I think Madball played, but it was like insane. It was fucking crazy. It was packed.
Yeah, that's so cool. And I find it weird, the transition point of obviously, like, you know, going to, I mean, it's not too weird, but just like, because usually you have certain areas that are obviously very, very heavily ska influenced, like, you know, being from Southern California, like I couldn't escape ska, but Long Island is never associated really as a hotbed of that sort of stuff. But, you know, what kind of pulled you towards that?
I know specifically, I mean, like while I was listening to hardcore, I was listening to like just any music I could get my hands on. The kid who lived around the block for me, Matt Shields, his brother Mark had some CDs, and I grabbed a Mr. Bungle CD because I knew Mike Patton was in Faith No More, and it was that first record, and it's kind of a ska record, and I really, really liked it, and then I didn't think anything about it. And then I heard about the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones, and I feel like, I don't know, I think I might have just read about them in a magazine, or just like I thought their aesthetic for that record, Question of the Answers, looked cool, like the cop car, I thought like it just looked cool. And they had like a phone number that you could call where you could listen to like a snippet of the record, and it was like a snippet of Hell of a Hat where they're like screaming, and I was like, oh, this is sick, this is a fucking hardcore band. And then I, like, a friend of mine had the CD and lent it to me. And I remembered, like, liking the parts where they yelled a lot and thinking the ska parts. I was just like, wait, what the fuck is this? This is, like, polka? What is happening here? And then, like, eventually I just liked that CD so much that I just listened to it over and over. And I, like, really liked those parts. And I played the sax and I'd learned the songs on the sax. And then it was just kind of like finding out more stuff from there, like my buddy Russell, who lived around the block from me, gave me like a Less Than Jake tape. I was like, oh wow, this is super, super cool, this is fun. And so like I just kind of got into it from there, and there was a great ska scene in Long Island. Like there were ska bands in my high school that were really good, like the Lightweights and the Posers, and like those were two ska bands and they were fucking awesome. And so I think I was just like finding all this stuff and seeing these bands that were in my high school that were good. I was like, I want to do that. I could do that. So it just kind of like happened from there. And it, you know, it didn't hurt that the songs were fun, and the songs were also like kind of sad and dark, which no one ever really remembers about ska. But like the 90s ska punk shit, but like, you know, like the Suicide Machines and Less Than Jake, and especially Operation Ivy, like all those bands are just singing about isolation and alienation and not really feeling comfortable in your own skin. And that was something I really, really, really related to a lot. And I kind of felt lost listening to a band like The Germs, for example. Like, I don't know, I didn't really relate to Lexicon Devil or Forming or anything like that. But like, I could tell you every single word in that Operation Ivy CD, because I just sat and listened to it over and over again, because I was like, this guy fucking understands what I'm talking about, you know? Minor Threat is the same way. It just like, those bands. It's just like, yeah, yeah. It's kind of like very energetic music about feeling bad, which I think is what I really, really liked about it.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. Yeah, you obviously don't couple ska with, you know, really introspective lyrics, because most people are paying attention to like, oh, it's, yeah, like you said, fun, upbeat, whatever, that sort of stuff. But it's like, yeah.
Yeah, I think most people are just like, oh, it's not cool. The lyrics are stupid. They're goofy. This is dumb. They're playing horns. This is stupid. This is dumb. Where's my indie rock? It's just like, whatever.
No, totally, totally. Yeah, because it's like, you know, stuff... I started to be able to, you know, allow myself to listen to ska once it was like, because, you know, I was just like a hardcore kid, and it was like, oh,
you broke up a little bit there. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. I was just saying it was one of those things where, you know, I started to allow myself to like ska bands because, of course, being a hardcore kid, it's like, never the two shall meet. But then.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. But yeah, there was at the PWAC, there was a room called the emo room, and all the ska bands always had to play the emo room. And that was a small room that was like shamed by the hardcore kids. I felt like, also I was 14. Maybe it was all in my head.
No, that's amazing. But it's like, yeah, a band like Voodoo Glow Skulls, or it's like you said, Suicide Machines, like those bands were dealing with, you know, very specific points of view that usually obviously relied on, like you said, isolation or feeling kind of left out. And yeah, it's just most people, like you said, just don't pay attention to it.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different things that stress us out, right? Like maybe it's something really, really small, like, man, that parking space, it's always taken. And I wish that I would be able to like get it instead of, you know, this person that maybe, you know, is the most courteous and considerate. I know that's something very random, but it's true. We all experience different things throughout the day that trigger us in so many different ways. And there are many times where I have been like, I wish that I had a spot or a repository for me to, you know, get this stuff off of my chest. Because if you bottle it up, that is no bueno. And then all of a sudden you explode on a coworker or a friend or a family member being like, the parking spot. And people are like, what are you talking about? That is where therapy comes in. And I love working with BetterHelp because I'm a huge advocate for therapy, broadly speaking. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, please give BetterHelp a try. It is so easy because it's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you do is fill out a brief questionnaire, and then you get matched with a licensed therapist. And if you are not vibing with the therapist for any reason, you can switch it out at no additional charge. Get things off of your chest with BetterHelp. So visit betterhelp.com/ray today to get 10% off of your first month. That's betterhelp.com/ray.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with a king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
If your business needs a new application, then developers will have to write code, a lot of code. If an application needs to be modernized, then you'll need time, resources, and caffeine. If that sounds daunting, then you need Watson X Code Assistant, AI designed to multiply developer productivity so you can generate code quickly. Let's create a more modern foundation for business with Watson X Code Assistant. Learn more at ibm.com/codeassistant. IBM. Let's create.
Yeah, but I mean, at the same time, I kind of like, and it's so funny because I've since there's like a ska song that lasts like half a minute on the record, every time I talk to somebody about this record, I've end up talking about ska. And what I'm realizing is that like, it was music for outcasts, and it still is music for outcasts. Like, it's not fucking cool. It's not there to be cool. It's there for people who are not cool. And it makes sense that people talk shit about it, you know?
Oh yeah, no, absolutely.
And so, like, you know, once you obviously started to experience, you know, kind of putting your first band together and, you know, playing shows and stuff like that, I presume at that point it was one of those things where everything else kind of fell to the wayside and you were just like, oh, this is all I want to do. I just want to play shows and, you know, eventually go on tour.
Yeah, I mean, well, it kind of, like, before I had a band, I just, like, sat in my room with my guitar and a tape recorder, and I would just write, like, these shitty songs and just record them in my tape recorder. And I had a tape recorder that was not good enough to fully tape over what you had previously recorded. So for me, that was kind of, like, a bit of a recording blessing that I could, like, play guitar and then put in my headphones and sing along to it, or put, like, a guitar lead on top of it, and then it would, like, the guitar was recorded so loud that the vocals, that, like, recording just singing on top of it, wouldn't tape over the whole thing. So you'd kind of have this weird multi-track demo on a tape recorder that just has a record button and, like, a shitty mic input.
Nice.
So I just, like, I kind of sat around and did that all the time. Like, when I got home from school, like, that was just what I did. I would also, like, hop on the computer and, like, I got this program called Cakewalk, illegally when I was a kid, from, like, some AOL chat room shit. I would just, like, write songs. I would, like, MIDI them out, and I would, like, score, like, horn parts and, like, every guitar part going, like, na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na, like, that kind of shit with it.
So good.
I was doing that, and then, yeah, by the time, like, I realized that there were people who would want to play in a band with me, like, my brother's friend Joe Werfelman was like, hey, we should start a band. And I was like, okay, cool. Like, and I'm already, like, writing songs, so this is how they should go. You want to write these songs? And it was just kind of like, I was doing, like, that was already a thing before the band started. And I think, like, the biggest hurdle was, like, trying to learn songs completely as a unit. And I feel like that took years before we actually figured it out. But, like, yeah, once we did that, and we were in high school, like, once we had gotten to that point, Long Island had such a good local ska, punk, hardcore scene that, like, you could just play shows every day on the weekend if you wanted to. And we did. And that was, like, the only thing we wanted to do.
No, that's amazing. I mean, I always found it funny too, where, like, obviously as you get to tour more and spend more time on the road, I always looked at, you know, people that had, you know, five or usually like six or seven piece bands. And I'm like, man, I can't believe you tour like that. There's way too many bodies in the van. You know, like, you got so many people in there. It's like, you know, I always loved it when it's like, oh man, there's just four people in the van. Like, this is so much more comfortable. One body makes a huge difference.
Yeah, it does. That's, and, you know, just like, yeah, trying to feed fucking seven people. It's like a nightmare. For sure.
Yeah. Where do you want to go? I don't know. Where do you want to go? I don't know.
Well, I mean, just even like, yeah. Yeah. Well, even just trying to pay for food, you know?
Yeah.
Trying to figure out everything for that many people. It's just like, it's hard.
Totally. It's like, then you have your two vegans in the band and then one vegetarian. And then you're like, oh, but then we're not going to eat at some shitty, you know, corporate thing. Like, we maybe have to, you know, do this, and everyone has their own needs.
Yeah. I mean, we kind of always end up, yeah, we figure stuff out. I mean, that doesn't change no matter how big your band is, at least for me. Like, I feel like our dietary complications in our current band, we're so all over the fucking map that it's like, there's literally not a single place we can eat where somebody won't be like, all right, you know?
Right. Someone's like, cool, looks like I'm just getting the sides here. Looks like I'm getting fries.
Yeah. Yeah, basically.
Did you, you know, how did your parents react to you obviously getting into this subculture and this stuff that they probably didn't understand?
Well, you know, they wanted me to think about school, and they wanted me to think about classes and other shit and really focus on my future stuff. And I didn't want to do that. I just wanted to do music. And so, I don't know, it was weird. It was a weird time. Looking back on it, they could have, I don't know. they certainly could have been worse, and I don't blame them for in any way for like being like, oh fuck, like you're just like never, you've just abandoned all like hopes of like being on like the football team or like doing honors science or honors this or any of this shit like your brother and sister have, and you're just like having your older friend pick you up in his Jetta where like you guys all smoke cigarettes in the car and like go to like VFW halls and have these like unchaperoned shows where a bunch of teenagers smack into each other. You know, they had about the reaction that you would expect to have from that. Maybe a little bit on the, I mean, like I did it, like they didn't like lock me in the house or anything like that, you know? But there were certainly times where they were just like, I don't know, not super happy with what I was doing, but right. What are you going to do? I mean, that's very understandable, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. They were like, we're just concerned about Jeff. We don't want him to throw his life away.
Yeah, basically. I don't know. It's tough because like, I mean, ask me when I'm 16 and I would have had a lot of strong words about this, but like, to be honest, I'm fucking 34 now and I understand that my parents are just human beings and I love them to death, and you know, I don't want to talk shit about my parents, you know what I mean?
No, well, like, because you understand it from, because like, especially where it's like, you know, I'm gonna find it interesting where it's like, whatever, I mean, I have a 5-year-old and I'm 36, and it's one of those things where it's like, when the moment he brings home something I don't understand, that's the exact same way that our parents felt when we were like bringing home, you know, records and wanting to go to shows. And they're like, what the fuck do you mean going to shows? Like, is it a concert? And you're like, no, it's a show. Like, that whole discussion goes in cycles, and you just don't, you know, you understand where your parents are coming from when you know, face it yourself.
Exactly. And I mean, and honestly, there was a point where I just like stopped talking to them about it. Like, I remember, like our house was under construction. So I was like sleeping in a room towards the back of my house where I could like sneak it through the back door. And I remember coming home late one day and like my mom was waiting for me. She's like, you're home at like 2:00 in the morning. And I was like, yeah. And then and that was pretty much it. And then that was that. It was just like, yeah, I mean, I don't know what you're going to do. Are you going to like, you're not going to sit back here and watch me all the time. Like, I'm not drunk. I was just out with my friends and making music and talking about music. And you're just like, fuck, okay. Well, you know, it'd probably be too much of a headache to try and rein me in, you know?
Right.
But I mean, also I like, for whatever reason, like I didn't spend a lot of time at home. Like, I would spend a lot of time at my band friends' houses and stuff like that. And then I'd come home and like go to bed and then wake up and then just kind of do that again. I didn't spend a lot of time at home. I think because I know because it was tense, you know? And that tension really fucking stressed me out. So like our band and it was, I think it was similar for the other guys in ASOB in a lot of ways, which is how we ended up kind of becoming a family and supporting each other, you know?
Yeah, totally. Cause you can retreat into one another and be like, okay, well, we know that we can support each other. And obviously our parents, you know, are just having difficulties with this. So let's support each other.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, my parents, great, great folks. If I was 34 and lived in their house now, I'd be like, I'm sorry.
Totally, totally. And so then, you know, obviously as you started to kind of have, you know, visions of touring and kind of, you know, whatever, making music your life, was there any other thing that kind of entered the picture in regards to like, oh, maybe, you know, I could just kind of do this as a career or whatever? Or was it always just like, I'll just, you know, work shitty jobs or not shitty, I shouldn't say that. I'll work temporary jobs in order to, you know, give me the ability to like, you know, drop everything and go on tour when I need to.
Yeah, it was always the second thing, to be honest with you. I never thought of it as something that I would do for my career in any way whatsoever. Like, this, like, as far as like production stuff goes, like music production stuff, like that's what I wanted to do when I was a kid as a job. But I think as I started to get more into things, it seemed less appealing to me to like kind of financialize my passions. So my plan was always just like have a job and then also do music and try and balance the two and try not put too much pressure on on music, and also try to not do the thing that we do, just as Americans, maybe as humans. I haven't grown up anywhere else but America, but where, like, you're kind of taught that your career is supposed to be every single thing in your life. It's supposed to be the thing that you focus on completely, entirely. But I've always just thought of it as like, a job is just something that you do to make money. And I think since, I've always had a bit of a distaste for spending money and stuff like that, that I just was like, okay, so I don't need to like freak out about this, and I'm just going to work these things and kind of have that as like, that's how I pay rent, and that's how I pay bills, and that's how I buy food and booze, and like, that's cool. And then the band will be the band, and it'll be fun. And if we could break even, that'll be cool. And I think once we started doing better than breaking even, it was like, oh, holy shit, this is crazy. I have to like actually think about doing this.
Right.
And when that happened, like, I think I was more hesitant than my friends were. Like when Bomb broke up, and I had a job that I didn't particularly like, and it was a temp job where they offered me a full-time job, and I knew they were going to offer me a full-time job because I was doing a good job at it. It was graphic design stuff, and again, everyone in my graphic design department, super nice, liked them a lot, but it was just like not really what I wanted to do. And I talked to my now wife about it, and I talked to my parents about it, and I talked to like my Parker as Asian Man about it, and I think everybody was just like, yeah, dude, stop being a fucking idiot. Like, make music. You've been doing this for like 15 years, and you're still like ignoring the fact that this is what you are supposed to be doing. And I think because of that, that was like the first time I was like, okay, I'll see if I'll try and like actually do this, you know?
Right. Yeah. It's like, it's honestly getting over that mental hurdle of just like, oh, I guess I'll allow myself to do this.
Yeah, I think so. And I think for me, it's just kind of like, I never wanted to make any music or do anything involving music that felt dishonest and felt like I was being pulled that way just because I had to make money to pay bills. So I was always just like, okay, I'll make money to pay bills some other way, and I'll also make music. Yeah, which I think is a repeat of exactly what I just said.
No.
Cool.
Hey, that's perfect. It's a nice bookend. You're like, hey, I can summarize everything of what I said in just like 2 seconds.
Yeah, for those of you who listened to all of it, you could have just skipped over the last 3 minutes where I figured out what to say.
Yeah, it's perfect.
Yeah.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
If your business needs a new application, then developers will have to write code, a lot of code. If an application needs to be modernized, then you'll need time, resources, and caffeine. If that sounds daunting, then you need Watson X Code Assistant, AI designed to multiply developer productivity so you can generate code quickly. Let's create a more modern foundation for business with Watson X Code Assistant. Learn more at ibm.com/codeassistant. IBM. Let's create.
Hey, have you ever used Cheapo Air?
For years, and I really like it. With Cheapo Air, you can book online, use their app, or even over the phone. They've got great prices on over 500 airlines and millions of accommodations. They're my go-to for travel planning. And if you join their Club Miles program, you can earn points to save on the cost of your travel. Book on the app, and you get double points.
Sounds like it's time I tried Cheapo Air.
Call Cheapo Air at 855-247-3279 or visit cheapoair.com/podcast.
Some of the stuff that you address in your new record specifically, the idea, you know, obviously most people that are involved in a subculture and then grow older with it and then are still passionate about it have to grapple with the fact that it's like, oh, well, now I'm old within the context of this thing that is essentially youth culture. But then still obviously holding on to all of this that you've learned because it's so important. You know, so it's like the idea of pushing against like, oh, you can grow older and still be that same person, that, you know, same 16-year-old punk ethos kid, but you can just obviously do it in different contexts. You know, how there's like no real question wrapped up into this, but, you know, walk me through the kind of process of you know, when you first started to, I guess, kind of push against that wall of like, oh, shit, do I need to like, quote unquote, grow up or can I be this person still in an adult society?
Well, I mean, I think I still wonder that, you know what I mean? I still grapple with that. And I'm not like, I don't know. I don't feel like I am a 16-year-old. I feel like I'm a 34-year-old. I feel like I'm the age that I am, you know? Like, I just am doing a different thing. And I think a lot of the times that kind of gets interpreted a different way. Like, yeah, you're holding on to something, but it's just like, no, the things that like kind of built the character in me, were the things that I'm still doing, you know? And it is strange to be older than the people at the shows and stuff like that. And I don't certainly, I'm not like hanging out with like 17-year-olds and being like, hey, I'm one of the gang or anything like that. You know, that'd be fucking, I don't know. That's just not me. Right. But like, I don't know. All like, I guess punk ethos shit really, really, informed the way I think about things at a time where, school and authority figures and, kind of like the path that's laid in for you. That didn't resonate with me at all. That seemed horrible to me. It seemed shitty. It seemed stupid to me to like work until you could like buy a house and put a fucking flat screen TV in it and get a fancy car and get like a nice refrigerator with three different kinds of ice makers in it and like be able to eat at fancy restaurants and like buy fancy booze and like do all the shit. Like I just kind of never, that none of that luxury really ever was appealing to me. So I think that just because of that, that just like automatically kind of got me started in a weird way where like I wasn't really thinking about that stuff. But I think like as far as like just punk goes, like the thing I always take from it is just the energy. And that's like at a graphic design job too, like, or if I'm working at a temp agency, like I'm always just kind of like fired up and excited to do stuff. You know what I mean? And I think that that's something that I'm happy I've retained since I was a teenager. I think I have them more now than when I was a teenager, to be honest with you. I think that a lot of the times people see that as like, oh yeah, you know, you still have that youthful energy. And it's like, no, I just like, I know that having energy is an important part of being alive. And I kind of have to like, if I want to be alive, I kind of just want to be the person who I want to be, you know, there's no point in this whole fucking thing. If I'm just trying to, you know, fit the pegs in the holes. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh no, absolutely. I mean, I think it's most people, cause you know, most people, obviously the idea of, you know, growing complacent, whatever that may be, or comfortable, whatever you want to classify it as. I mean, that's, I think that's when people obviously start to give up on the idea of, like you said, either having that energy, having that, you know, desire to learn or whatever, all those things that people can attribute to quote unquote being alive. And, yeah, I think that's, it's a very, you know, it's a very tricky line for obviously people that, you know, such whatever people like you and I, where we're so involved in a subculture and we still care about it and we still, you know, foster it by being creative within it. But then sometimes people obviously on the outside look at this and are just like, oh, that's cool. You're still doing like cute kid shit, you know?
Yeah, you know what? I used to think that, and I don't think it's like that anymore. I think a lot of the time during Bond the Music Industry, I was thinking that my friends were thinking that. Mm-hmm. And then I did this crazy thing, which I actually talked to my friends about things, like who had jobs. And like, they're all kind of stoked on what I'm doing. And I think that was a big thing for me to know that like my buddies who had jobs were like proud of me. And were excited that I was doing stuff. And I was just like, okay, so I'm not doing this fucked up dumb thing. Like, I just kind of lucked out and got to keep doing this. And especially again, when Bomb broke up, it's like, it sits in the mouth if you don't enjoy it and don't try and do whatever the fuck you want with it, you know? Like, if you're gonna, I feel like music-wise, if I was going to try to, like, fit into whatever I should be doing to be more popular or any shit like that, then I'd rather just have another job. And so the fact that I haven't done that and I've still been able to do this for, like the past year or so, I've been able to do it as my job, like, that fucking kicks ass. Like, I'm not, I don't want to just, like, throw that away because everybody else is kind of doing something differently, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, totally.
And I mean, and still, like, and I was still able to get married, and, like, we've talked about having kids, and we've had practical discussions about, like, how we would do that if we were doing things this way. And, like, you know, it's not like I'm never talking about that shit, thinking about that stuff. And I'm always just kind of trying to figure a way, like, okay, well, you know, kind of like how I ended up doing stuff with music. It's just like, how would I do that the way that I want, the, in a way that, like, makes sense for us, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's important to take a look at yourself and the individual that you want to be, and try and just do whatever you can to live a life that lets you be yourself completely. And I feel incredibly lucky that I've been able to fight through a lot of shit and be able to do that, you know?
No, absolutely. And so the idea of when, like you said, when you first started to be like, oh, like this, you know, we actually came home from tour and we have money. Like, do you have any of those moments that you obviously, like, reflect on and look back on as being like, oh, wow, like, I feel like there's momentum or people caring about what we're doing? It doesn't have to be from, like, either a big show perspective or the fact that, you know, we made like $1,000 at this show. This is insane. But I'm sure you have some moments kicking around your head that you kind of always look back at being like, wow, that was a pretty pivotal thing.
Yeah, the really big one for me is when I booked a tour for Bomb the Music Industry, which was, like, especially at the beginning more so than the end, was a collective. And it was people like, if you could come on tour, you could come on tour. If you can't come on tour, you can't come on tour. Not a big deal. I had a temp job at the time that I could leave when I wanted to. So I had a more flexible schedule. And nobody in the band could go on tour. And we were supposed to go on tour with my buddy, Rick, who played in the Rick Johnson Rock and Roll Machine. I called him up. I was like, yeah, tour's off. He's like, no, why don't I just play bass? And you could sing and play guitar. And, like, all your stuff is like drum machine and synthesizer anyway. Why don't we just put that on a thing and go on tour? I was like, well, okay, I'll try it. And the first day of that tour, we played with my buddy Matt Kurz, who had a one-man band where it was just like him playing the bass with his foot. And, like, he wrote really, really great songs, like replacement-y songs, just like great fucking songs. And we were like, hey, you should just ask your job if you could take 2 weeks off and come on tour with us. And he did. And I remember being, like, in Florida on that tour, and, like, by the time we were down there, just thinking, like I remember calling Christine and just being like, hey, so this Bomb the Music Industry thing is a thing. Like, it worked. Like, people are talking to me about, like, donation records and stuff like that, and, like, or not donation, like, free music, and everybody's really excited, and people have been donating money and stuff, and, like, it's going really well. And I'm going to start a label, and I'm going to put out Matt's record because Matt's awesome and he just made a record. He doesn't know what to do with it. And I'm going to start a thing so people get his record for free too, and they could donate if they want to. And then I came home and quote unquote record started. And that, like, really became a very, very big and important thing in my life. Was like everybody for the past year has been telling me is stupid. Is not stupid. It was actually just a new idea, you know?
Yeah, totally. People may have not been ready for it in the context that you were presenting it in.
Yeah, and I'm sure alongside the music that I was presenting it with, people were like,
yeah,
there's just somebody screaming over a lot of distortion. This sucks.
Yeah, for sure.
Not that I think it sucks, but you know, right, yes. I know how the general public feels.
This is not for everybody, as they say.
Yeah. I've had relatives say like, oh, so I've heard your band, you know?
Right, exactly. You know, the fact that when you originally mentioned that you were in community theater, it doesn't shock me based on the fact that, you know, you seem to be relatively comfortable with the idea of kind of being, you know, obviously the quote unquote center of attention, not like you're asking for it, but obviously, you know, people that sing in bands, like that's kind of a thing that obviously happens as a byproduct of playing in a band. Was that something you kind of had to like grow into, or was it, you know, you could kind of take what you've learned in community theater and sort of, you know, translate that into the fact that, yeah, I'm comfortable on stage?
I mean, I assume that has something to do with it, but like, I don't think about it at all. And I don't like attention. I don't like taking pictures with people. I like talking to people, but it makes me feel uncomfortable when people, I'm not great at taking compliments. I know that. I've been told that a lot. I'm not like if somebody comes up to me and says a nice thing, like I don't know what to fucking do. I've got some pretty low fucking self-esteem, which is, you know, I just deal with, no big deal. But it makes me feel, a lot of that makes me feel uncomfortable. Like the thought of doing that kind of just, makes me really nervous. But I think that when I try and think about what might be happening, why I do end up like playing the way that I do, is I think I just have a lot of nervous energy, and like when I'm up there, I'm kind of just blacked out and kind of just going, and like I'm just trying to do a good job. Like I'm not thinking about too much. I'm just trying to do a good job. Like I'm aware of what's happening. I'm just trying to sing and play correctly, and most of the time I'm just kind of like unaware and really, really in a weird zone that I can't entirely figure out what it is. And I try not to think about it too much. I feel like that's probably a good thing. And even if it's not a good thing, thinking about it won't be a good thing. So, right. You know, yeah, I don't know. I'm sure like having done community theater and like high school plays and shit, like made me feel comfortable with the stage and like applause and all that stuff. But yeah, beyond like, I don't like pull out any tricks or like, I don't know, that's not something that's ever really aware that I'm really ever aware of. But I mean, I know it's in there, so I don't know.
Yeah. No.
How's that a non-answer to you?
No. No, it was
question.
It was, no, you did great. It was perfect.
Wow. Thanks. Thanks a lot. I told you I get compliments. Anyway.
But that, you know, kind of coupled with that is the fact, like you mentioned, and you've publicly mentioned before, where it's just like, you know, you've dealt with a lot of anxiety and a lot of, general malaise. You know, what were those things that obviously you utilized, to, you know, just kind of push through obviously whatever it is, or completely, you know, face it head on and just kind of, you know, address it?
Yeah. Well, I feel really lucky that I found music and that I found writing, especially at such a young age where I was like really dealing with it. It really helped me deal with it. And like, as I realized that growing up, I really appreciate the fact that I'm able to compartmentalize a lot of the things that come along with depression and anxiety. And I've been able to kind of compartmentalize that into when I'm writing, and to when I'm playing. And, yeah, I don't know. That's just kind of how I deal with that stuff. And again, I feel, and that's probably why I am going to keep doing this. Like, even if I had a job, I'd still write songs and record them and like send them, put them up on the internet or whatever, you know, like I would just do it for free still. Like it's not so good. It's ever going to stop for me, just because, while I am overjoyed and ecstatic and over the moon and beyond appreciative that people seem to be enjoying it as of late. Like, it doesn't matter to me. Like, I'm writing songs because I need to write those songs. So I'm going to like keep doing that.
There's two last things I want to head on before I let you go was, obviously your decision to release music through Side One Dummy. When that was first announced, it was like, oh yeah, it makes total sense because, Side One Dummy, the way that they operate their label is very much, you know, what a lot of labels existed in, whatever in the mid 90s, where it was like this very familial vibe where it's like, you know, if you pick up one record by a band on this label, you probably will like the other bands in this label, even though they may not sound exactly alike. I presume that was very deliberate, like when you first started to kind of entertain the idea of working with labels, that it needed to foster some sort of feeling like that to make it feel like you're obviously a part of something as opposed to just like this cog in the machine.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, definitely. I didn't realize Side One Dummy was a label like that until I was on the label, to be honest with you. It just, like, they hit me up right after we were done recording We Cool, and it was just kind of like, I didn't expect it to happen, and like I was saying before, I just asked people's advice, and everybody was just like, you should go for it. And I met them all, and they were all really nice. They were all super nice, and I liked them a lot. And so that was kind of more of it than anything. It was just like meeting Christina and Jamie initially from Side One Dummy right off the bat. Like, they were just fun to hang out with. And when I had, like, I went to Side One Dummy to talk to them a little bit about, like, possibly doing the record together, like, right before I flew over to Australia to do the first Smith Street Man record that I did. I just remember hanging out and just being like, oh, so this is just, like, it was just, like, it just felt like a familial vibe, personality-wise, for the people who worked at Side One Dummy. The only other labels I've really worked with, like Asian Man Records, is Mike Park and Skylar and Bob, and those guys are my friends and I still hang out with them. And my buddy Pete, who runs EJRC, who helped me put out Vacation, like, he's a good friend. Like, they're all really good friends, and I think at Side One Dummy, when I met them, it seemed like we kind of just vibed on the same thing. So I was like, okay, cool, I like them. And then I asked them if I could put the music out for free still, and they said yeah. And then, well, they said no, and then I said please, and then they said yeah. And so that just kind of was it. And then I kind of realized later on that, yeah, everybody on Side One Dummy, especially right now, like, we're all buds, and it's really cool, and I like everyone on that label, and it's awesome, and they keep signing more buddies of mine, and I'm just like, sick, Allison Lace is on the label now, that's fun, Chris Farron's on the label now, that rules, yeah, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And obviously, like you mentioned earlier, production seems to be something that you're obviously getting into, and that's always something you've kind of had a vision for. I presume now you kind of feel obviously ready to take on that handle, whereas maybe, you know, whatever, 5 to 10 years ago, you might not have felt like you maybe could have done the best job at it. Have you always felt ready?
No, I mean, it's a matter of like mustering up confidence and trying to remember that you're there for a reason and somebody asks you to be there. So like, if you say something, you're being helpful, you're not being stupid, which is something I just grapple with constantly all the time. But like the first situation that was like kind of pro that I was in was that Smith Street Band record, Throw Me in the River, and like right off the bat we were in an expensive recording studio, like a nice recording studio, with the engineer who did the Cat Power record, Moon Picks, and did like the first Living End record, maybe the first two Living End records. They have like the Avalanches were in the fucking B room there, and I'm just like this fucking scrub from Long Island, just like, oh, okay. And I remember Matt Voigt, the engineer, was just really nice to me, and didn't make me feel like I did not belong there. And when I would suggest things like, hey, let's put up a wall at the end of the room and let's put a microphone behind it and let's bury it, I think it'll sound cool, it'll sound fucked up and weird, like, did it. And we ended up using that mic, and I was like, okay, great. And it's just kind of like little things like that have happened. Like when I suggest something, and people are like, yeah, let's do it. And then I hear it back and it sounds good and the band's happy. Like, more and more when that happens, I'm just like, okay, cool. I'm into this. I'm doing a good job. And then also it's just a matter of, just trying to be friends with the people you're working with and looking out for their songs and trying to make sure that they're all doing the things that they want it to do and being honest and helping out where they're like, I don't know what the song should do here. Being like, try this. Or being honest, you're like, hey, I heard the demo. This part goes on for a long fucking time and it doesn't need to. Maybe get rid of some of it. Like, just not feeling weird about doing that and also accepting everybody else's ideas. So it's cool. I think I just do a good job at it because I like music, and I really like doing it. The whole confidence thing and trying to like tell people what to do, I'm not super good at that, but you know, I'm just constantly trying to grapple with it. Like, I don't feel like I'm necessarily all that much better at that than I ever have been.
Sure.
But at the same time, it's like people are asking me to do it. I got to do it, you know? Like, I don't know. I'm not going to fucking turn down any music job, especially when it's something that like I kind of dreamed about doing when I was a kid, just because I'm scared of doing it, you know? Like, if I fuck it up, send me home. And I haven't fucked anything up too bad just yet, so I still get to do it, I guess, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And then, like I mentioned at the you know, onset of our chat, was the fact that, you know, you've done a lot of podcasts with, like, you know, being a co-host on Going Off Track and stuff like that. You know, you personally seem to obviously ask, you know, really kind of introspective and, you know, digging questions or leading questions. Has it always been kind of natural for you to, I guess, either share so much about yourself or obviously be inquisitive, of the deeper sides of life, so to speak?
I don't know. I think I'm just, I take no pleasure in lying. I find it incredibly stressful and anxious, and I don't like doing it. That's why I'm generally so honest. I also can't shut up. So I have a good combination of, like, I talk too much and I like lying is not fun for me in any way. So I think that's why I'm like kind of like that myself. And, I don't know. And it's, I just ask questions cause I'm curious about things. You know, I guess I've probably read a lot of interviews with a lot of musicians and a lot of people, and I find stuff like that interesting. So I'm just trying to ask the thing that I think is interesting. Like when I went to school, like I was trying to do journalism for a little bit cause I thought that was really interesting. And then I just never ended up going that way. But like, I don't know. I kind of like, when I was a kid, I would make like fake fanzines on the computer for like Green Day and Offspring and like write fake interviews up. And then eventually like I would interview them myself and stuff. And, not those bands, like smaller bands, but like, you know, I think that it just kind of comes from, I don't know, I've always been interested in bands. I'm always curious how they work. Like right now I'm at a studio, and John in Yellow, who is a fucking amazing engineer, who's worked with Sonic Youth and Dinosaur Jr. and the Thermals and and countless great bands, like worked on a Cyndi Lauper record. Like, all I want to do right now is go in there and ask him 5,000 questions about a million things. So I think like when I'm talking to somebody interesting, I just want to ask them a lot of stuff. And maybe also if I'm asking like dark questions, it's like just me just being like, fuck, how do you get through it? Cause sometimes I don't know how to fucking get through it, you know?
Right. Totally. You're like, I'm actually looking for, there's no question here. I'm just looking for
some advice. What the hell do I do?
Totally. I'm actually using you for my own personal benefit. Please.
Yeah, please. Tell me, my resume is not good. How do I format this? How do you format your resume, Bobby Moynihan? Yeah.
that would be absolutely incredible if you like physically pulled out like your computer and like we're like doing a like step-by-step process with a person on the podcast.
Yeah, asking for a friend. I don't know my bank password. How do you find it?
Totally. Could you? What's the 800 number you call? That's incredible.
Yeah. Do you know it? How do I get through to customer service on this thing? I've been on the line for a long time, Mike Yerg.
Yes, help me out. Well, Jeff, I really appreciate you hanging out and making time in your day, because I know you're a busy dude. But yeah, this has been fun for me, and I hope it hasn't been too painful for you.
It's been just the right amount of pain for me. Thanks a lot for speaking to me. I really appreciate it.
So there was Mr. Rosenstock. Just a pleasant chat with that fine gentleman. So yes, that was much, much needed for myself. And anytime I'm able to have these conversations, because I know a lot of people have been giving me, you know, feedback questions where it's like, man, how are you even able to, like, you know, do anything right now with all of the kind of chaos that's swirling around you? And really, it's kind of the work that I do is what's able to kind of keep me going. Because, you know, if you sit around being focused on something and you're kind of playing out every single scenario in your head, that doesn't do anybody any good. Not only does it do me, I was about to say an injustice, but that's not, that's such an overstatement. But it doesn't do me any good if I'm sitting in this negative headspace. It doesn't do my wife any good sitting in this negative headspace. And so this podcast exists to be a vehicle for creative expression. And that creative expression will get out even in times of tragedy, which what I'm experiencing right now. So thank you very much for listening. And thank you to Jeff, and thank you to Jamie at Side One Dummy for always helping out the show and bringing me some cool people to talk to. And happy Thanksgiving, because you are more likely than not listening to this either, you know, days after or on Thanksgiving. And hopefully you kind of sit around and whatever situation you're in, whether it's a room full of friends, room full of family, or if it's just, you know, with one loved one, it doesn't matter. You really, you just soak it in. Just really appreciate the, you know, little nuances of the moment. Stuff that is pretty small and inconsequential may end up playing a much larger part in your life much later, where you're just like, man, I remember that necklace you wore on that one night, or I remember that shirt you were wearing with that cool thing on it or whatever. It's just, those are the memories that kind of stick in your head. It's just, it's wild when that stuff may get taken away from you, is when you just remember some really, really specific things about your life. So anyways, I just encourage you to be thankful for everybody around you, and hopefully the, you know, fear that a lot of us are feeling inside can be turned away for, even if it's just a couple hours, and focus on the people that you care about the most. So there's my Thanksgiving message, and hopefully you're you know, enjoying it, not eating some animals as well, because that's important, you know. How about you eat some mashed potatoes, right? Anyways, happy Thanksgiving, and I will be back next week. I'm not even going to tell you. Well, should I tell you? Yeah, I think I'm going to tell you. So next week's episode is with Billy Reimer, the drummer of the Dillinger Escape Plan. And it was a very weird yet cool conversation I had with him, because he was like loading drums, and I never like to speak to people when they're on tour, but this was kind of a necessity. So yeah, that is what's happening next week. And please, until then, be safe, everybody. Like I tell you every single week, but really, truly this time, be safe, everybody.
You've been listening to the Jabberjaw Podcast Network, jabberjawmedia.com. Shh.
The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Trust me in saying that no matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all of the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey, guys. Back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah.
and some waves so we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby.
Wait. Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.